Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, there's a new documentary out called Our Blue World, A Water Odyssey. It's like a love letter, an ode to the life-giving liquid that we consume every day and may take for granted. It's narrated by Liam Neeson, no less. And the documentary travels the globe to meet the people who want us to cherish our rivers and to help us understand how important water is and how it will impact if we don't treat it well. The documentary maker joins us now in studio. He's water scientist Dr. Paul O'Callaghan from Middleton in Cork. Hello, Paul.
Hey, Ray. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it's a beautiful documentary. Thanks. You know, you could watch it with the sound down. It's beautifully shot and it travels all over the world. I nearly got dizzy. It's been, how many locations do you reckon are in it?
Oh, there could be up to a dozen, you know, but you can actually watch it with your eyes closed too, because the sound and the music's equally beautiful.
Everything about it is beautiful. And I was saying there, it's an ode to water. And it is something that we take for granted, particularly in this country, I suppose, because we're just surrounded by it and it rains so often. We've so many lovely rivers. We're an island, all those things.
Yeah.
But just in a couple of sentences before we get into you and the documentary, the future of water. What is the future of water? I know that sounds like an odd question.
Well, look, we have too much of it and too little of it, right? So it's kind of paradoxical. Leonardo da Vinci used to talk about that. It can be give life, it can take life. We are running out of it, and at the same time, we sometimes experience an awful lot of it.
Yeah.
There's only so much of it in the world since the world began, like 4 billion years, not a single new drop. So we have what we have, and we constantly reuse it. And that's the beautiful thing about it. It regenerates itself. It never runs out. And it's what gives life to this planet and any place else in the universe that there will be life. We expect there'll be water.
Yeah. But we're polluting it.
Yeah. That's a recent phenomenon in a way. I mean, like, if you know, 1,000 years ago, it wasn't that bad. It was very bad in the 60s and 70s, and then it got a bit better when we set up EPA organizations. So it's not as bad as it was, but we've got new problems. We've got pharmaceuticals, pesticides, nutrients, microplastics, things like that get into water.
And the flooding. We'll come to all of that in a moment. So, about you then, Middleton.
Yeah, I grew up outside Middleton, near the water, a place called East Ferry. And, you know, in the 1980s, we didn't have paddle boards or kayaks or anything, but we used to make rafts out of old wooden pallets and 5-gallon drums. So I grew up spending most of my summers paddling around the water there. And that was probably my first connection to water and my first connection to water pollution, because back then there was no treatment plants. And I became very aware of that as a teenager and noticed that just not enough was happening. And was motivated to try and do something about it with a group of friends, form our own little environmental movement there.
Right. And I've never met a water scientist before, so it's good to meet you. So your speciality is water, water treatment, water protection, everything about water.
Yeah, I'm like Forrest Gump, you know. I kind of know a lot about this subject. I've spent a lot of time in it, so I should. I got a master's in water resource management following my undergrad, did a PhD in water in the Netherlands. Yeah, anything to do with science, technology, innovation, that's my area. I founded a company that specializes in this, and we now work with corporations like Apple, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Heineken, Intel, people you wouldn't think of, L'Oreal, because they all need water to do whatever it is they do, if you're making ice cream or computer chips. So we look at how tech and innovation can solve water. So that's how I come.
And I suppose the eyes of the world are on them now, how they treat their water and how they return the water to the environment.
More so than ever.
Yeah.
More so than ever, because in certain areas they're in competition with other people for water, with agriculture, with cities. Even Tesla, you know, got stopped building a gigafactory in Berlin because there wasn't enough water. Then we have AI, artificial intelligence, and data centers, and they need water to cool it. So there's a lot of pressure on those groups to come up with new ways to use less. I've even seen Microsoft helping Thames Water in London stop leaking pipes.
Right.
Because that's how precious it's becoming.
Okay. So the documentary sort of goes around the world and meets people who care as much as you do about water, and they all tell their stories, and they vary, and the locations vary from high up in the Andes to a bog in the west of Ireland, down to a river in New Zealand who has the same rights as a human being, and we go to China to find out about the sponge cities. And so, but the lady who appears throughout is a lady who starts her journey in Canada, and she's on a campaign to make our rivers' water drinkable again. Tell us about her.
So Leanne Poe, yeah, she's a really inspiring character. She spent some time in northern Quebec in Canada. And when she went there first, she was with the Cree Nation and she was drinking from the river. And she was really moved by that experience, the connection that that gave to her. Now, when she went back 3 years later, that river was polluted because of mining activity with mercury, and that affected her very deeply. And that set her on a life's mission to try and turn that back and restore the river. And now is on a campaign to help rivers all over the world do that. And part of how she does that is she walks and she walks. She's walked over 15,000 kilometres of rivers. And she gets, like, she'd go to the mayor of Dublin, say, you're the mayor of Dublin, but you're also the mayor of the River Liffey. And then she'd go to every town and village, upstream and downstream, and say, hey, what are we all doing about the river? And she gets kids to walk near the river and just open up their eyes to it, maybe in a way they hadn't done before. And she's been really successful. And we were delighted to tell her story, beginning back where it all started for her in Quebec, but then follow her to the Vector River in the Netherlands, and ultimately to New York, where there was a big United Nations Water Summit.
Yeah, and they had a ceremony there at the beginning of that summit, and they carried a glass of water from Central Park to the Hudson River, and she returned the water to the Hudson River, and she was talking about an aspiration that the water in the Hudson River, which flows through New York, would be drinkable.
Yeah.
Will that day come?
Well, do you know what I love about it? Who wouldn't want it to come?
Yeah, I know. Yes.
You know, we talk often about what we don't want, you know, polar bears and ice caps, but who wouldn't want to drink a river? It's imminently desirable.
Yeah.
And look, if we get to swimmable, like we saw in the River Seine, everyone wanted those triathletes to be able to swim in the River Seine in Paris for the Olympics. The whole world was willing it into existence. If you want something to happen, that's the first step.
Okay.
And you can.
Well, you mentioned the mayor of Dublin, and you met the mayor of Greenville. And Greenville is a town on the Mississippi. And the Mississippi, if people know their geography, flows right down through America. And 100 mayors who are presiding over towns on the Mississippi are now cooperating. To do what?
To try and help cope with the ebbs and the flows of the mighty Mississippi. Like, that river's been there as long as America's been there. And when an individual mayor tries to do something on their own, they can't. Not against a river that big. And they are coming together to try and leave room for the river. Not always try and control the river with levees, because those can break, as we saw in New Orleans. So they're uniting. Oftentimes people talk about water wars, that we'll all fight wars over water. That can happen. But a lot of time people come together because it's one thing we can all agree on. If your house gets flooded, it doesn't matter what colour you are, what religion you are, Democrat, Republican. So it's amazing, because these are Republicans and Democrats who wouldn't normally talk to one another, like, now more so than ever. But what they've done is they've come together in this consortium from Chicago all the way down to New Orleans and said, if we don't work together, we're all going to be affected. If there's not enough water, we can't move goods. If there's too much water, we got flooding.
Mm-hmm. And of course, man has interfered with the flow of certain rivers, and nature doesn't like that.
There's an expression, water always wins, we use. So we've interrupted the flow of about 80% of the world's rivers. We like to control. We have like to control water, put it in a straight line, get it to move fast, in and out, very transactional, build a lot of concrete. That doesn't really work. And it's certainly not working at the moment.
Right. Now, in New Zealand, they have, this is a landmark judgment at the highest level of the highest court in New Zealand, where they've granted a river human rights. Am I reading that correctly?
You are. It's a funny idea, isn't it? You know, but we all think that a corporation has a right, like a personhood, and no one seems to question that, right? You could be sued by a corporation. Well, the Maori had this deep belief that they'd held for, you know, hundreds of years, that the river is alive. The river is like a person. And, you know, somehow we all kind of feel that. If you walk by a river, I mean, they have songs about them, stories. So their big victory was they kept campaigning until eventually they got politicians in New Zealand to listen to this and say, yeah, you know what, we'll enshrine that into our constitution. And now when we do things in the future, we're going to view the river like a person.
Okay. So anything that's done that would affect the river has to, what has to happen?
Respect the rights of the river.
Respect the rights of the river.
They have a word in their language, tamana o tawai, which is like the health of the river, the river's life force. So they have to mine that life force in the river. And I think their great victory really was to keep that alive for hundreds and hundreds of years through music, song, their language. And so if they're doing any planning, they have to take into consideration what's it going to do to the life force of that river.
So is that more than a sort of an environmental impact report?
It is. But, you know, an environmental impact report's a very good step. An environmental impact report can talk about minimising risk and this type of thing. The way you manage water means you ought to understand the river. And you have to understand that it needs a certain amount of water to function. You can't drain it down too much. It'd be an extension of that, I would say, yeah.
Okay.
But it's something that like places all over the world are now doing. Other rivers have been granted legal personhood. So what happened in New Zealand is now being replicated elsewhere.
Now, in China, and there's this thing called the urban flood. And it makes sense if you've loads of concrete that it upsets the natural rhythm of water that used to soak into the ground because water can't soak through concrete. So that is... then ends up in what they call urban floods. So this man you met, he's a landscape architect, he's designed sponge cities.
Yeah, the very word sponge cities, you're curious, aren't you?
Yes.
You're wondering, what's that mean? Well, I'd heard about these things. I'd been to China, I don't know if you've been to China.
I haven't been to China, no.
Well, the first time I went there, my abiding memory was it's full of concrete, the air is polluted, a lot of traffic. I'd heard about this guy Kang Jianyu and these sponge cities, and I was incredibly curious. They looked beautiful in photographs. The idea was you build your cities not to stop water from getting into the ground, but to hold on to it with trees, with ponds, with lakes, with wetlands. And when we went there, it was just after China opened up after COVID-19. We were the first film crew in there, and they're generally pretty suspicious about film crews going to China. But we had a very good story, I think, to share, which was Kang Jian had fought and fought against the government to say we shouldn't be doing what happened in the West. We shouldn't just build concrete everywhere. And then there was this huge flood in Beijing. And after that flood, the government changed their mind. And they said, OK, let's try this. Let's try this in one city. And they did. And now there's 50 cities all over China and it's spreading. And the thing is, they're beautiful. They're not like what you picture these cities like at all. Like you'd want to walk through them. Old people are there, young people are there, and literally in the middle.
So it's on the outskirts of the city.
No, right in the heart of it.
Right in the heart of it, right. Yeah. And it's a wetland.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
It's not a park as such, although there are park bits of it.
It looks like a park, but when you know what you're looking at, it's really a constructed, engineered wetland. But nobody would ever really notice that unless you knew what you're looking for.
Okay. And that's then, it returns the equilibrium of the water moving around the place.
Well, it's like what, as Kang Jian would say, like... farmers in China for thousands of years when they were building rice paddies, they always left a little bit of room because those mighty rivers, the Mekong, the Pearl River, the Yangtze, when they flood, it's catastrophic. So you've got to leave a bit of room for them. So what they're doing is just leaving that space, that breathing room. So there are ponds which hold the water, but they'll clean it and they'll purify the water. They'll cool the place down as well.
Yeah.
So it's a good thing to do in climate change.
And Ireland is featured as well. And it's re-wetting the bogs. This guy, Dutch guy, is he Dutch or...?
Dutch, actually. Yeah, Dutch yeah. Irish at this stage.
Yes, yeah. So he came here in the 70s and realised that we were wrecking all our bogs. And he's fought since then. And eventually we now realise that it's a good thing to re-wet the bogs.
Yeah, it's a beautiful story of one man's journey and what he's achieved. Matthias Schouten and came here in the 70s, saw us draining our bogs, and he described it as watching the land bleeding. That once they're drained of the water, they die. And we've all viewed, not just in Ireland, but globally, we view wetlands as non-productive. I mean, drain the swamp has a certain connotation. But really, they're a fundamental part of the ecosystem. And Kang Jian, sorry, I can't use the sponge city guy, but Matthias Schouten, environmental philosopher, he founded the Irish Peatlands Association and helped build that movement to restore the bogs and re-wet them. And now we're seeing farmers all over the country doing that and I suppose, taking... something we took for granted and valuing it more.
That's going to affect our carbon footprint as a country.
100%. Like, you know, acre for acre, a wetland holds four times more carbons than a forest does.
Right.
They hold on to that carbon. And we often focus in this country about methane and, you know, agriculture. But really, we could do an awful lot by restoring our wetlands.
Our Blue World, a water odyssey. Where can people see it, Paul?
So for now, we're doing a global tour of film festivals. We just featured the Dublin International Film Festival on Monday night as part of a sustainability gala, which is wonderful. That's paving the way now for a nationwide tour at universities across Ireland, DCU, UCD, TCD, all the universities. If you want to attend any of these, please reach out to us. And I include schools, community groups, teachers.
You'll do special screenings 100%. If you're invited.
100%. Okay. Or indeed, we'll provide a link for the schools to screen the film.
Okay.
We want it to be shared in classroom
situations. How can
situations.
They get to you?
www.braveblue.world, or if you Google Paul O'Callaghan and the word water, I'll usually pop up.
Okay. Paul O'Callaghan, Dr. Paul O'Callaghan, thanks so much for coming in. Fascinating stuff. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Ray.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.